This morning, as we think about labor and work and offering that to the Lord, instead of a sermon this morning, I've invited several people to come and talk about the work that they do for the Lord in our community here. And in a moment, you'll hear from them. They aren't the only ones in our church. I've tried to actually choose some that we don't hear much about very often, but Jim Coyman and Kim Shepherd work with the Egan Warming Center, and Pete Slindy with the Family Shelter, and Roger Bastew with Love, Inc., and John Wilkes develops software to help people who are struggling, Kristen is our liaison to Dove Medical. Kristen Wilkes is our liaison to Dove Medical. Bethel Willicks, actually, her job is to work at India Partners, and Kent Willicks works with the Pacific Rim Art Guild, and Mark Brower there works at the Opportunity Center at Goodwill, and there are others, I'm sure, that I'm neglecting. Farther afield, Gary and Mitzi Barker go to Haiti and serve there, and Trudy works with Team Missions and has been many places in the world, as well as Kay and Dan traveling for missions similarly, and all of you serve in blessed and holy ways outside of these four walls. You don't just serve Jesus when you're here at church and doing something in this building. You serve Jesus all the time in other places. And so we're going to get a taste of that, and I'm going to ask the people to come in the order that's listed in the bulletin, and would you just introduce yourselves and come up one after another as we share together this morning.
Hello, everybody. I'm Mary Bartlett, and I, in addition to being a very enthusiastic and grateful member of Valley Covenant Church, I am the board president of Women's Space. Women's Space is a nonprofit based here in Eugene. We just celebrated our 40th anniversary, so they've been around for a while. Women's Space has their office on 15th and Pearl Street. We occupy the second floor of the building, and another nonprofit, Ophelia's Place, occupies the first floor. I got involved in Women's Space. I haven't had any direct experience myself with violence from a partner or a husband, but I have had friends affected by it, and I had two very good friends serving on the board, so it was an easy fix for me. I wanted to tell you a little bit about our services, and the correct term that we talk about at Women's Space is domestic violence is what most people think about, but it's really intimate partner violence, IPV, which is a more inclusive term, can include a boyfriend, girlfriend in high school, even kids in elementary school, so it's a much more inclusive term is intimate partner violence. And I'll just read a little bit from our website and then tell you a little bit about our services. Women's Space is a local nonprofit organization that serves victims and survivors of domestic violence in intimate partner relationships. We provide emergency crisis intervention to help victims and their children escape the immediate danger of abusive relationships, but we also provide support services that help them transform from victims to survivors. So that's a big part of what we do, is helping people get back and on track with their lives. We serve about 5,000 adults and children a year at Women's Space, and Women's Space is one of the largest nonprofits of its kind in Oregon that fights intimate partner violence. For instance, Portland has a lot more agencies that do that work, but we as an agency in Lane County, because our county is so big, are actually one of the largest in Oregon, which I recently found out. We provide services not only in Eugene Springfield, but we have advocates that work in Cottage Grove, Cresswell, Oak Ridge, Junction City, Veneta, and also Florence. And as most of you know, Lane County is a very, very large county. And one of the biggest challenges that we face is serving people in the rural communities. Each community has its own culture. Each community has its own law enforcement culture. And oftentimes, those victims in those rural areas are really the most difficult to help. And so we're very, very committed not only to Eugene and Springfield, but also to our rural communities, which is really important. Some of the services that we provide is emergency services. So we have a 24-hour crisis line that people can call at any time. We have walk-in services Monday through Friday at our office. And our immediate goal is to remove people who are in danger. So we have a what we call a safe house, which is a shelter. We wish we had more capacity, but we can house 15 individuals at our shelter, and it is at a secret location, so it's not open to the public. But if somebody comes in and needs help right away, we can put them into our shelter if we have room. If we don't have room, then what we do is we partner with other shelters, or we give motel vouchers. The immediate goal is to remove the person from harm. And we serve both men and women. Largely, our clients are women, but we also serve men, and we've had men in our shelter as well. So, again, trying to think about a more inclusive look at who might be affected by this problem. We provide lots and lots of support groups at Women's Space, and we have a lot in Spanish, so we serve a pretty large Latino population at Women's Space. We provide help for people that need career training, financial literacy, anything to help them get back on their feet, to help them and their families be independent. We do a lot of community education, so we go out into the schools, we talk to government agencies that we partner with, we also talk to a lot of community groups about what we do, and with the focus on prevention, especially in the schools, to help healthy relationships, that kind of thing. And then we have a big legal advocacy part, because we help people with restraining orders, how to get out of difficult situations, those kinds of things. So we partner with tons of organizations here locally that really help us with this work, so we don't do it ourselves. Our budget is about $3 million, and we have about 45 employees at Women's Space, so it's a pretty big organization. Not all of our employees are full-time, but we have a whole department that is what we call our rural advocates and is run by a very skilled manager. And so I would say probably 15 of those employees are dedicated to areas outside of Eugene and Springfield. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we are having a series of activities at Women's Space. And if anybody is interested in attending, supporting us, please see me. We'd love to have you join us. So see me after service, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Janet Gilo, and I, many of you know, work at Jasper Mountain. I've been there since 1991. It was a short-term temporary job that kind of grew. I started as the bookkeeper. I'm currently the business manager there, and also oversee human resources and contracting. So worn a lot of hats there and experienced a lot while I've been here. So for those of you that aren't as familiar with Jasper Mountain, we have a mission to help kids that are not being helped elsewhere. It started very small back in 1982. We're hitting our 35th year anniversary this year with a vision of helping kids who had no other place to go, another hope, because of what they'd experienced and the behaviors that kind of grew out of that. So that became, over time, at Jasper Mountain Center, which is out east of Springfield, almost out to Lowell. It's about a 100-acre piece of property that has a residence there, a school there. We've got a variety of activities. There's a horse program, all of that. It's a psychiatric residential treatment center. That would be like one step down or slightly down from, like, you would imagine a psychiatric hospital. But it's nothing like a hospital, and that's the good news. So we've always focused, like I said, on kids who didn't have other options. And it wasn't clear when we first started who those kids were going to be exactly. In fact, the original vision was kids who or families that experienced some sort of death, grief needing support. Very quickly, it moved into the world of kids who had experienced abuse, neglect. The kids that we serve at the Jasper Mountain Center site are kids that have had extreme backgrounds of abuse, neglect. Most of them have also experienced like death in the family, incarcerated parents. Maybe they don't have anybody that claims them anymore. And they are behaviorally very, very difficult to place and actually not safe given their self-harming behaviors or how they act out their rage and grief. So where do those kids go? Well, my joy has been to be working at Jasper Mountain, where we create a place for those kids that's not just a treatment center, but actually a beautiful, healthy, joyful child life place where kids get to kind of, while they're getting intensive treatment, they get to maybe experience some childhood that they got lost along the way. The kids we serve range between 4 years old, yes, four, and 13. And they stay with us at the Jasper Mountain site about 2 years, maybe even sometimes longer. We're an absolute outlier. No one serves kids that long, but the kind of kids that we serve are kids that cannot be quickly fixed. There is no 13 sessions or less that are going to fix the kind of damage that these children have experienced. And so because we work with kids who don't have another place to go, we are afforded this wonderful niche. You know, Mary, what she does, all the other programs that you are going to hear about today and a myriad of others, it's like this community comes together and each one does its piece. So everything that Mary does or that other people that you hear about today, it all kind of works together. So our niche, our piece, are the kids who literally have nowhere else to go. We have another section of what we do, and that's the Safe Center. Safe Center is just outside of Springfield. It serves some similar kids and also some different kids. It's more of an evaluation center. You actually might experience kids in this community that have been at the Safe Center for a period of time. And the goal there is to work with kids that have experienced abuse, or there can be kids that have a complex situation internally and externally that no one can quite figure out. What's going on? What's going to help this kid? What do they really need? And the great thing is that we have this in this community. Not every community has this. And so we bring in all sorts of pieces. Well, we have the kids live there, and then they can stay for school after they leave. There can be a transition out, same at Jasper Mountain Center. It gets complicated. What I want to say mostly is that we don't do what we do alone, that we deal with really extreme situations, and I am thankful that I ended up landing there to be able to see human beings do their best to put it together and try to make a difference in lost causes, in very difficult situations. I am honored to be part of a community of people that some of our staff are new, some of them have been there a very long time. Each one brings their strengths and weaknesses, me included, and I've been a part of that family for a while, and I've seen some really beautiful and amazing transformations in children, which at the end of the day helps you get through. Another thing I want to say about, you know, this team effort is that from a business manager perspective, I deal with a lot of other pieces, not just the kids. I deal with our insurance, the liability insurance, the health insurance. I deal with the employees. I deal with the contractors. I deal with people that don't pay their bills. I deal with people that do pay their bills. I deal with the electrical company. All of those pieces and parts. And I will tell you, in whatever role you are playing in this world, don't downplay the fact that being a good worker wherever you are makes a difference. I can tell you there have been government workers who have made my day and who have broken my day. There have been contractors who showed up on time that made a huge difference. All of the little pieces of what each of you do, in my case, I'm just at a place where all of us in our office have way more to do than we can do. And so when I have somebody I can rely on, a contractor, a business partner, an insurance broker that's willing to fight for our employees' health insurance, I mean, I'll tell you, there are some beautiful and amazing people in this community who have helped us, who are just doing their jobs well. And I would say that to everyone here, you don't have to be in social services to make a difference. You make a difference for me and for us. In whatever ways that you do your job well, you make a difference for kids. So I just wanted to mention that. The third thing I just wanted to mention, in case it's of help, and if you have any need, you let me know individually, but we do run a 24/7 crisis hotline, and we'd share that, again, partnership with Looking Glass, Youth and Family Services, and they handle the teen side of things, and the Child Center, which is another school out East Springfield. And the three agencies came together and said, how can we prevent immediate crisis situations? How can we help? Because that's the kind when a family is in crisis, that's when kids are most vulnerable to either being explosive and hurtful themselves or being hurt. And so came up 12 years ago with a crazy idea that we could collaborate and provide this 24/7 hotline and overnight three-day stays for kids, young kids, which we do at the Safe Center, when there is chaos and crisis in place. So if you have any interest or need in knowing about how to access that service, you let me know. The numbers out there our community uses. We serve about... Well, we have about 100, and I would say an average 125 crisis calls a month for families and children in critical need throughout this country county. And I would say, it's a big county. So Florence to Blue River, we divide it up. And if there is a crisis that is not going well and we feel the kid's not safe, we will go to the home rather than sending police. Police often don't know exactly what to do with kids who are in high levels of distress. So we partner with the police, but also we take the hit when it comes to going in and making sure everything's stable and safe and taking the kid to a safe place with the parents' consent for a couple of days if it's not. So just wanted to mention that, that is a service that's accessible to you, your neighbor, anybody you know. The final thing I would say is that I get, since I'm keyed into the quality assurance side of things, I always worry about what happens when we don't do it perfectly. And I think Mary probably experiences this too. There's just, I do my hand wringing. I want everything to go just right. We are like all of you in your workplaces, we are human beings who are both gifted and flawed, and we try our best. And I just want to affirm all of us in that to keep up the good fight of working together as human beings to do something to make the world better for other people, and just put that out there for your encouragement and my own encouragement. So thanks for listening.
Thank you, Janet, and thank you, Mary, in particular. I'm Stan Hahn. I'm an architect and own a small construction company here in Eugene. December last year, we began a conversation over in the other building about Emerald Village, Eugene. We call it EVE, E-V-E, acronym, as one option for addressing homelessness and housing challenges that face many of our residents here in Eugene, Springfield. So I framed that conversation, A Place to Lay Your Head. There's a lot of references to housing in the Bible. And one, you're probably familiar with Jesus' comment that foxes have dens and birds have nests, but he had no place to lay his head. so with many of our residents. There are many options in this community, many of which we're involved with as a congregation. From car camping, we have guests out in the parking lot. As you leave, you'll see them. The safe spots, many of you toured in December. The interfaith shelter in which we participate on a weekly basis with two other churches in our neighborhood. The Conestoga huts that are variously placed around town in churches. Nightingale, the Eugene Mission, the warming center that we host. These are all places that are options for folks in our community who are homeless. They're all temporary, non-sustainable places for people to stay, but they fill a need and do good work. And so these images pick up some of those that you may have driven by and seen. With those go services, and the services become just as critical as the places. The services that, like First Place that supports the family shelter, or the service center on Highway 99 where our Egan guests can go for day support. St. Vinny's does a wonderful job in administering many programs in the community, including the car camping program here. So services address individuals' needs and circumstances, and in some ways those are all essential to moving up the housing ladder, if you will. The 4 years ago, we began a program called Opportunity Village. It's located on Garfield on some leased land from the city of Eugene. It's a very temporary, but in some ways it's another option for some folks. It gives them a place to live in a Conestoga hut with no power, no water, really no heat, a community building, but they're in a gated community with some accountability to a community council. So again, there's support, there's a place, and for some folks, it's the right answer. The goal is really transition out of it. And so 2 years ago, I attended a meeting to hear about and explore a new model that we've developed that we call Emerald Village, and just share a brief update on where we're at with it. Let's go. There we go. Doesn't read real well. This is the site that we selected up on Railroad Boulevard. And the essence of Emerald Village is we set up a nonprofit called Square One Villages as an umbrella over Opportunity Village, Eve, and some other programs that are now in process in Cottage Grove, Veneta, and other outlying communities. But the goal was to use a model of permanent tiny houses. So what's 160 to 390 square foot home, permanently built, permanent foundation, code compliant, fully permitted, on a development that is forever, not a one-year revocable lease. Community dining, community laundry, a gated enclosure, community council for that accountability and support. So I agreed to participate. I and my associate in the office adopted a house, and we adopted it to say we would design it, permit it, fundraise to create it, and then build it, and then turn it over to the nonprofit. And so here's an overview of that site. We are in the upper right corner, but not in the corner in the middle, and I don't have a laser to show you where we're at. Talk to me later. We began the process of site review with the city because it was in an industrial zone in a Whitaker Special Area neighborhood. But again, the goal was to do everything legally and permitted and permanently in terms of the structures to provide this option. So Emerald Village, in a nutshell, the soft part, but the important part is there's a council that selects residents. They become owners of a share of the property. So they pay their $250 to $350 a month, that includes utilities, for their home once they've been selected. But a piece of that goes into escrow so that at the time they relocate to another community, need to leave, they can sell, if you will, their share of the co-op. So they become owners, not renters. So again, thinking about the housing ladder of options, you've been on the street, you've been in some other alternative settings. This is another place that's still below, say, Section 8 housing that has a 5-year waiting list for 3-bedroom units right now with the Housing Authority. it becomes another option. So where are we at? Let's flip on. Last October, we had the groundbreaking because we thought we were nearly done with the city. We were surprised. But the mayor is here helping with the groundbreaking as well as some preliminarily approved residents. Here's a model of our home, quote-unquote. We're unit N. We're one of 22. But I will say that I'm pleased to say that I think 13 other architectural firms adopted a house and have put a team together to make it happen, and then the nonprofit structure is building the other eight with some assistance from the university and some students. Design-build partners, go ahead. So by April of this year, we're permitted and ready to go when the mud cleared. Go ahead. By July of this year, this is a month ago, our site specifically was formed, plumbed, and ready to go. And by the way, I think we've got 22 inspections, and we're about six down the road right now. Go ahead. We poured concrete on July 29th. Go ahead. Get you up to date to, this is 2 weeks ago. We're framed, and go ahead. Last weekend, doesn't show real well, but we're actually sited and ready for a roof, and we began working on the roof framing yesterday. Maybe by the end of October, we'll be ready for occupancy in some of the units, we hope in ours specifically. What do we learn from it? Well, it takes a lot of options to have a place to lay your head. It's actually laying your head, a place to put your stuff if you're on the street. Having a secure place to know it'll be there each day and not have to pack it with you is huge. Having a key to your front door is huge. Having a place that you won't get kicked out of in a couple months when something goes sideways is huge. Our goal is to provide a place, you know, kind of one starfish at a time, for people to have a place to live with pride and joy and dignity and some sense of security. And so we're doing a little piece of it. Thank you.
I'm Brian, and this is Dan. He can introduce himself, though he's a man that needs no introduction in many ways. we're up here to talk about hospice and our ministry there, and I do want to also say we have others in the congregation who are an active part of helping in hospice, either in the past or the present. I know that Harry and Shirley volunteered for hospice and did good work there, and Kathleen Fletchall also is an active volunteer, and she does amazing work.
You're stealing my thunder.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to just acknowledge that at the beginning, but Dan's got plenty of thunder yet to come. He's our newest volunteer. But what is hospice all about? Well, just to kind of jump back in history to give us some big picture context, in the Roman times, the church was caring for the ill and for the dying. And through many centuries, the church has been an active part of helping people who were profoundly sick and those who were near the end of life. Hospice itself started in 1967 in London. And in 1974, the first hospice opened in the United States in Connecticut. In 1982, not that long ago, it became a Medicare benefit. And so, you know, funding streams began to make it a permanent part of a medical system. And in many ways, it's a response to the medical system, to industrialization, to modernization, to systemization of people and illnesses. And sometimes people felt that curing was elevated above caring. And they felt like, you know, there were all these interventions going on at the end of life that weren't really that necessary when people just wanted some quiet and time to connect with their family as their bodies come to the end. And so part of the purpose of hospice is to balance and that sense of caring and curing, recognizing that at some point in each one of our lives, no matter how young or old we are, there will not be a cure. The emphasis of hospice is on in-home care. We have a hospice house on the other side of town, with one hospice organization, and hospice also goes into to various medical facilities, nursing homes, things like that. but the ideal target is in the home. I was hired in hospice in 2016 at Sacred Heart Hospice. Our offices are right downtown by the University District. And my role is a chaplain, and I serve both in three roles. In a chaplain with palliative care, which is people with life-limiting long-term illnesses. You know, many been given, you know, a modestly short diagnosis, 5 years or something like that, if a timeline is set to it. Many times, you know, if someone has cancer or something, they don't give a timeline until things get much more critical. So I serve with palliative care and then with hospice patients and in bereavement. After a loved one passes away on hospice, the hospice organization provides bereavement support for 9 months afterwards. And so as a chaplain, I do emotional and spiritual support to the patients and to their families. And what I enjoy about that part of the hospice work is I enjoy hearing people's stories. There's some amazing people in this community, just a few blocks away at Churchill Estates and all these different places around town, or people in their homes that hardly anyone talks to. Whether it's someone who fought valiantly in World War II or invented some cool thing for aeronautics, or you know, has these amazing gifts in other ways. People that none of us see as much anymore just because of health and their station of life. It's a joy to hear their stories. And I get to support them and their families, and it's also a privilege to pray with them and help prepare them for eternity with Christ. I work on a team with nurses and social workers, also with physicians, and especially with volunteers. Dan is our newest volunteer, one of the newest volunteers at hospice, and there are many families who say that their time with hospice was made profound by the volunteers that were a part of their care. So Dan's going to talk about volunteers.
I'll go away. Stay here for more.
No, you go ahead.
No, all right. Correct me if I say something wrong. Right?
I'll look over your shoulder.
And steal my thunder, huh? No, by that remark, I only meant that I know of at least four people, including Brian, who either are actively in hospice or have been. And I just want to mention that just in this congregation. Well, my first wife, Susan, died in early 1983 of colon cancer, and hospice was there with her and us in the final weeks. I hadn't heard of hospice before, and as Brian said, it only came to this country in 72, what did you say? 74, yeah, so about 9 years. And at that time, or perhaps that was my impression, I thought it was just the final weeks. I didn't know anything about the possible 6 months help. We didn't even know until about 3 months before she died. That's what she had. That early experience with hospice and the help those people gave us put a lasting memory and sense of gratitude in my heart. Now, and since last April, I finally get a chance to give back in some ways to the organization that was so kind to Susan and my family. Our family. It's a very practical and very well-organized group of dedicated people, both volunteers and staff, and operates with a fairly small staff considering the impact it has on the community. But all of them make a wholehearted commitment to service to each other and to the folks they serve. What I've done mostly so far is respite care. In such cases, I stay with a person who is terminally ill for up to 4 hours in order to give the caregiver or caregivers some time away for personal or practical needs they couldn't otherwise take care of without that respite. And again, I have an appreciation for how important this is, because when Kay's husband, Larry, who gradually deteriorated in his life-threatening and finally fatal illness, she had him at home with her for at least 3 years before he finally went into an institution. And the time she had respite care, I mean, it was almost life-saving. Almost literally life-saving. It just was such a help. So I am glad to do it, and I am just there for a few hours each time. The first time I sat with an ill person, he was so wired up with different kind of life-saving or life-sustaining equipment, we couldn't really talk. I don't think he really wanted to anyway. So we watched a ball game together instead while the people went out and took care of things they needed. The second time, I had more interaction with the person, and I enjoyed talking with them. But again, they were terminally ill and not in the best of shape, and just getting out a sentence took a while. Another time, I went to see a couple in a care facility for people, usually older, who are mostly bedridden. These people were not terribly ill, but they didn't have long to live, and so they couldn't get around on their own. All the same, this couple certainly had all their marbles, and we talked about the man's part in World War II and Jimmy Stewart and the fact that he served in the military, D-Day, military airplanes, movies, books we've enjoyed over the years. I was really sorry when our time was up, but they needed to nap, so I guess I couldn't have stayed much longer anyway. Even the training as volunteers was interesting and very helpful. It's a rather intensive 5 days, and it only comes around once a year. If you miss it, you got to wait, and you want to be part of this, you've got to wait another 11 months or so for the next one. It was about a dozen people. This has almost always been my case. Mostly women. I think there were 3 men and about 9 or 10 women. And it lasted those 5 days. These classes are usually done only once a year, as I said. And is that correct? It's just once a year? Yeah. All right. See, he said so, too. Well, the training was very practical and very useful, and as important as it was to hear what we should do was to hear what we should not and could not do. So, to keep it briefer, I'm just going to stop there. There's an awful lot more that we could tell you about it, but that's true of every volunteer service we could talk about today. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah. Thanks. And I couldn't come up here without my Bible. It's just too tempting. I wanted to just share just a brief reflection to end our talk about hospice. And, I mean, as Steve shared in the children's message, part of what we do in hospice is to help families carry that burden of death. And we all die. And we know death was introduced in the fall and a consequence of sin. And Moses, at the end of his life, according to tradition, wrote Psalm 90. And in Psalm 90, he says, one of the verses in verse 9, "For all our days pass away under your wrath. Our years come to an end like a sigh." And the Bible talks about death as that last enemy that Christ defeated. And we fight death all of our life, from seatbelts that we put on to come here, to eating spinach in good proportion, to having surgeries. And in medical situations, I've seen many families say, "We're going to fight this," or "so-and-so is a fighter, and he's going to pull through." But we know at some point, it's a fight that we will lose. In Hebrews 9, it says that it's appointed unto mortals to die, and after that, the judgment. So how do we as Christians face this truth? The world wants to deny it, to hide it, to say if you go to CrossFit enough that it won't happen to you. But yet we read in the gospel this morning of how Peter's denial of Jesus' death was going against Jesus' mission in the gospel. Moses says in Psalm 92, he has this prayer to God to teach us to number our days that we may gain a wise heart. So we're called to number our days, to recognize as Christians we all will go at one time or another. And we can be ready to go because we believe in the resurrection. We believe the best is yet to come, that death is ultimately defeated, even if it brings an end to our story in this present age. And so, you know, as we read in Romans, we're called to be at peace with all people, to keep short accounts. Whenever, you know, our end might come, we can say, "There's nobody who needs to forgive us," or "I've forgiven everyone that I've needed to." That we can say that we can be generous, that we're not hoarding money. We can freely give, knowing that Christ gave all, and we can recognize that our life is short in the grand scheme of things. And also I was in Psalm 91, which is another psalm on aging. There's a prayer in there, Psalm 71, verse 17 and 18. This prayer of a person up in years says, "O God, from my youth you have taught me, and I still proclaim your wondrous deeds. So even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim your might to all the generations to come." Here is a person of many years still having that sense of God's mission in the world, still that call to proclaim God's glory to the end of their days. And so as we think about our mortality, we can thank God for our time and make the most of every opportunity, recognizing that death is a part of our current natural cycle. And in Psalm 116, it says, in verse 15, "The precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his faithful ones." And so in Christian death, there's a nobility to it. There's a sense of being able to come to terms with things, to die in peace, knowing that we are, you know, right with our Maker, that we are right with our fellow humans. And as Jesus said on the cross, we can say, "It is finished." And in hospice, we come to accompany people in this time, medically, emotionally, spiritually. And it's a joy to be a part of that. You know, it's kind of a, you know, conversation-ending thing sometimes. "What do you do for a living?" "Oh, I work for hospice." "Oh." You know, it's not a cocktail party sort of statement, but, you know, it's quite profound. And I think there's many ways that we can prepare. I'll put in one plug. If you've not done an advance directive, it's a good idea to do so. If you don't know what one is, talk to me later. I can give you a whole earful on advance directives. And if you have a serious condition and you haven't done a POLST, which is called a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, it's a bright pink sheet, and if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. If you need one of those, I can help you with those as well. And also, I'll give a plug for this. This is Valley Covenant's conventionally called memorial service planning, but we like to call it witness to the resurrection planning. Steve has these, and it's a way to put down in words how you would want a memorial service for yourself to be done, and his songs, and his scriptures, who you would want to do a eulogy, that sort of thing. I'm not encouraging anyone to hurry to that point in their life, but it's good to be prepared. And in closing, I want to leave us with an image from Jacob, in the life of Jacob, at the end of the book of Genesis. When Jacob came to the end of his life, you know, he had 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, and he blesses each son, you know, and with Joseph, he blessed, what are his sons' name? Manasseh and Ephraim, right? Okay, so he blessed all of them. And after blessing his children, it says that Jacob charged them, saying to them, "I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my ancestors in the cave of the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre in the land of Canaan, in the field that Abraham bought from Ephron the Hittite as a burial site." And so Jacob had this whole plan for his own grave. It says, "There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried, and Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were purchased from the Hittites." And then this verse, "When Jacob ended his charge to his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people." It's a beautiful image of how we could come to our end in peace with our family, with our world, and with the Lord, to be gathered with our ancestors as we think about, you know, the future resurrection with the saints who've gone before us. So I leave that picture with you today. Thank you.
My name is Marcy Ryan, and I had a daughter and son-in-law living here, so I decided when I retired from working 30 years at a college that I would retire to Eugene. 20-plus years ago, there was a 3-month-old baby girl here in Eugene, and she had to be taken away from her 13-year-old mother. She had an imprint on her cheek from her mother's hand. May 4th, 2000, I joined 12 other people, and we were the first class of the court-appointed special advocates for Lane County and we had two people drop out even of that class. At that time, there were 400 children that had been taken away from their parents in Lane County. That class was the beginning of a training that still goes on to this day. My first case was a little 8-year-old girl in a wheelchair, blind, and had never lived with her parents. She had been living in Dornbecker. The mother wanted the child back, and she fought until she got her back. But at the same time, she was being investigated as a case of Munchausen by proxy. So I was assigned to her. I learned a lot of medical terms. I had to go through one whole box of papers that had accompanied this child. It was an entire lifetime of 8 years of paperwork. I decided I'd go to Lane Community College and take a medical terminology class so I would learn a little bit, and I did. And that was the beginning of a new education for me. That girl eventually, after 2 years, the mother was allowed to keep the girl and, of course, was watched for about 3 months after that. And that little girl is now happily with her mother. It was not a Munchausen by proxy case, but it had to be proven by the caseworkers. My second was two girls whose mother had become a Wiccan follower, so I had to read up on Wicca, which was considered a religion by Congress, but not until recently. And that meant another education as far as religion was concerned. Those two girls were given a possibility of staying with a couple of aunts in Bend. So then my travels extended into Bend. That happened for a year and a half, and the caseworker was from Bend. I learned how to interact with people that I did not agree with, if there was an attorney. If there is one child, it's a child's attorney that's appointed. If there is a mother and a father also involved in the case, a mother has a separate attorney, the father has a separate attorney. That means there's three attorneys that I interact with, and they all don't agree, obviously. And sometimes they don't agree with me. My third case was a co-case. I was asked to co-chair six children, and the person who was the primary CASA was working for the U of O, and she had to travel back and forth. So I had six children in addition to my one. We are asked to write court reports, which is at least once a year, and we work with the Citizen Review Board, and they are meeting every 6 months regarding our child or children. I have had 15 children since 2000. I'm on my 15th child now. I have learned that you can stand up for a child, be that child's voice, and no one else will agree with you as far as a path for that child. We stay with the child usually for 2 years. I had one child for 11 years. I started when he was 11 years old. He was picked up off the streets of Portland with his father. His father was begging on the streets. And the boy, actually it was he and his sister. The sister was eventually adopted. My boy was going to be adopted, but it turned out the information that I gave about his foster home turned out we had to close the foster home, which meant he did not get adopted. His sister did. That's just an average story about a child that lost a mother, lost his father, and then lost his sister. And it's a very common occurrence. I'm not going to go through all the roles that I play, but I do have a list of like 13 That is the role of the CASA, and I have extras to hand out afterwards. So please ask me a lot of questions. Another case that I had was a little boy, 5 years old, who was in a foster home, and they were going to adopt him. They had started adoption proceedings. He had, when he was 5 months old, been given milk in a bottle from his mother that had alcohol in it, and it continued until she was turned in. So he was taken away from the mother and placed in this foster home. The parents, the foster parents, started adoption proceedings. The adoption proceedings were halfway through when the mother decided she wanted the boy back. The mother's mother had talked her into start proceedings. And at that time, children are wanting to be with their parents, then that is the process that the child's attorney takes. And the caseworker and I disagreed. So on the day of the court hearing, the boy was returned to the mother, and she had bus tickets to go back to Montana immediately after the court hearing. Both the caseworker and I could not designate why she could not have the boy back. So that same day, that boy got on a bus, left early childhood education, and left everybody that had cared for him, and was awarded back to the mother. However, the caseworker and I talked with the judge afterwards, and we asked if we could remain on the case. He said yes. So I had to find a courtesy CASA in Montana, which I did. And for 11 months, that caseworker, that CASA was my eyes. And he was just starting a CASA program in Montana. 11 months later, we got the boy back here. We had been having a telephone conference once a month. The mother did not always attend that telephone call. And the CASA there in Montana shared the information, so much information, that we were able to bring him back. And he is now living happily with that family and has been adopted. Some outcomes are very good. Some are not as good. My next case involved the boy and his sister and the father that were found on the streets and begging in Portland. It was transferred to here because the father left Portland and chose to live with a sister here, and he thought that his son and daughter would benefit until he started showing up with alcohol in his breath during the supervised visits. As a CASA, I am allowed to interview and interact with any adult that is in that child's path once that child is placed in the state system. I can sit in on educational meetings. I can sit in on doctor's appointments. If they have a psych eval, which most of them do, I meet with a person afterwards and given all the paperwork. We are given so much credibility nowadays. We had a training session. Our training class was very nominal. We did not learn a lot of these things. Everything was by just accidental, just by experience, by sitting and watching these children or listening to the children. CASAs are allowed to have supervised visits. CASAs are allowed to interview doctors, dentists, any adult that comes within contact of that child. Eventually, after watching the 7 cases that I was involved with, my throat is dry. Sorry, my throat is dry. After being involved with so many court cases, I wanted to find out more information about the structure of the... Thank you. That's better. After being involved 15 years as a CASA, I wanted to find out more information regarding about courtesy CASAs in other states. I had an opportunity when one of my cases went to the state of Washington. And that happened because of the mother being allowed to transport the children to the state of Washington. And that turned into a more difficult case. I'm sorry. Smoke is getting to me. Anyway, what I started to say was that the... Sorry. What I started to say was that the nudges that you get from God when you start getting these nudges of stepping up for somebody, stepping up for a child, and speaking up for that child, whether the other people in the cases agree with you or not, we are allowed to interview any of the adults with him. One of the last things I wanted to share with you, that the one boy that I've had for 12 years had to have oral surgery and had to have braces. And I was able to find an oral surgeon that performed free and able to find a dentist that would become involved with his braces. Don't be afraid to speak up for a child. If you see somebody interacting inappropriately in a grocery store with their child, speak up for that child. There are many children that still do not have a voice and do not have anybody to stand up for them. All it takes is all it takes is one person to say, "Do you need help?" And it's also another way of helping is also to volunteer as a respite care for the foster parents. That's another area that's very needed. The foster parents, of course, have no respite. But the main thing is that we need to speak up for these children. There are still many in the system. When I started, there were 400. There are now over 1,400 in Lane County alone. That's just in one county. Some of these children have never had toys to play with. All they've had were beer cans to play with. There are just many, many instances. And sometimes you don't know what children have gone through.